From the Free Speech Project at Georgetown University, this is Speaking Freely. I'm Sanford Unger. When Vince Greco was studying for his master's degree, he read many of the same books as other students, but he wasn't a typical college student. He was an inmate in a Maryland prison.
I was attaining a graduate degree from Cal State University through correspondence, and they came in and took all my political science books. They took Rousseau, they took Machiavelli, they took Plato's Republic, they took all these.
What was dangerous about those?
A lot of people use Machiavelli and Art of War, you know, but I didn't have that one. I had actually a Kim Jong-il book that was part of my course requirements, though. And yeah. So, you know, I had to go through a whole lot to
this
get back.
This was the North Korean dictator.
Right, North Korean.
Before the current one. Right?
Before the current one. And it was part of the curriculum from Cal State, but I ended up getting them back.
And I've even heard about President Barack Obama. While he was president, his books were banned in a facility where somebody received them, and the person in the mailroom decided, no, these are dangerous.
That was Professor Mark Howard of Georgetown University. And before him, we heard the voice of Vince Greco. On this edition of Speaking Freely, we're talking with them about the free speech rights of the more than 2 million incarcerated Americans. The United States has more people in prison than any other country, and it has the highest rate per capita. According to the Sentencing Project, in the last 40 years, the number of people in prison has jumped by 500%. That's 500%. Vince Greco spent more than 30 years in prison. Since his release, he's become an advocate for prisoners' rights. Mark Howard is a professor of government and law at Georgetown, where he's also the director of the Prisons and Justice Initiative.
I think, frankly, much of society doesn't think about prisoners or prisons in general, which is a problem. But when they do, I think most people have no realization of how few rights people in prison have. In terms of free speech, there are very limited free speech rights that apply to mail, that apply to communication with families, but it's very easy for prisons to override that by asserting that there's a security need. Security kind of trumps everything. For example, there's a right to libraries in prisons, but many books are banned. Prisons, for very arbitrary reasons, will come up with a list of books, and sometimes it's, you know, classics. Catcher in the Rye has been banned, and other times, more recent books that deal with criminal justice, like The New Jim Crow, has been banned in hundreds of prisons.
Who makes those decisions? Who decides what?
Prison officials, generally, on an individual prison level, and sometimes it's at a state level as well. But usually it's wardens, or it's somebody even within the state. It might be the librarian, who might even be working part-time, who just says, oh, no, not this book. Or same thing with mail. Mail gets censored. Some magazines or some books that get sent to people, somebody in a mailroom might say, nope, this isn't getting through. I don't like it. And there's just very little recourse because people who are incarcerated have so few rights.
Is all the mail opened in prisons?
All the mail is open except for legal mail. Legal mail is the one privileged mail, so right. Where the content cannot be viewed by prison administrators. But otherwise, all mail is opened,
but
including
they
packages.
Open it, excuse me. They do open it in your presence, the legal mail. So they do search it.
Even the mail that doesn't get
right, they can't read
screened.
Right.
How does one make this point? I mean, I imagine the pushback would be, well, these people in prison were sentenced to be there because of some crimes they committed, they were convicted of.
Right.
And so they have forfeited certain rights as
That's
a
right.
result.
Clearly, the fact that somebody has committed a crime and is in prison, there's a certain measure where you want to make sure that they're not being incited to, or having the opportunity to incite others to commit further crimes and pursue criminal activities. So there's obviously justification for some control and some intervention that's different from out in free society. The problem is that it's gone so far to the extreme of complete control and intervention, and also in a very arbitrary way with very little recourse, because there's not exactly a prisoner's rights lobby or anything like that. But the tough on crime movement, and particularly the victims' right lobby, has pushed so far in a direction of depriving people of even basic communication rights, basic keeping ties with their loved ones, much less having rights to have their voice and image used outside of prison. and that's something that's been severely restricted in recent years.
The operating assumption seems to be just being here is not punishment enough, that you have to be deprived of some other rights as part of the unwritten part of your sentence.
That's right, and that's right. Where I think the U.S. really stands out compared to other countries, where the deprivation of liberty, so the separation from society, is the punishment. In this country, we add on all kinds of additional punishments. And Vince can, of course, talk about this from personal experience as well.
Vince, what happened with you?
I think what Mark was saying about the book ban, I went into prison in the early 80s, and there really wasn't that many books that were banned. It was pretty wide open. And then all of a sudden, somebody came in and they decided, well, we don't need chemistry books because we don't want them to learn how to make different chemicals. We don't need...
Theoretically for bombs or
yeah,
something.
Or
to learn how to make them.
Or to learn how to make
them. To use them on the outside.
Anything to do with the manufacturing of weapons and things like this. So this is where I first experienced it. And then we came to know what is, you know, the Son of Sam law, which then prohibits prisoners from writing about their crimes and making a profit off of their individual crimes. So what Mark has said, though, is that it has now just snowballed, and now we're dealing with no common sense when it comes to what books are banned. The new Jim Crow, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense why to ban that. What happened to me was they took, I was attending a graduate degree from Cal State University through correspondence, and they came in and took all my political science books. They took Rousseau, they took Machiavelli, they took Plato's Republic, they took all these.
What was dangerous about those?
A lot of people use Machiavelli and Art of War, you know, but I didn't have that one. I had actually a Kim Jong-il book that was part of my course requirements, though. And so, you know, I had to go through a whole lot to get
this
back.
This was the North Korean dictator.
Right, North Korean.
Before the current one. Right?
Before the current one. And it was part of the curriculum from Cal State. But I ended up getting them back. It was a hard fight.
How did you get them back?
Well, I went through the grievance processes, you know, so it could take up to 2 years ago to get your case into circuit court.
And I've even heard about President Barack Obama. While he was president, his books were banned in a facility where somebody received them, and the person in the mailroom decided, no, these are dangerous.
I'd just like to try to, maybe it's speculation, sort of think about why, say, victims' movements in particular would push so hard for this, and what they would do. They feel they're achieving something. I mean, do we have to try to understand what they're thinking?
I mean, I think there's a very legitimate reason to think carefully about the impact on victims, about having perpetrators of crimes that harm them have their names and images in the public, particularly if it's somehow profiting off
of
the crime,
sort of
getting notoriety.
Glamorize these people.
Right, right. And that's a real danger, and we don't want that to happen. So I don't have a problem with restriction of somebody causing harm to another person while they're in prison based on what they've done before. It's reached a point, and it's continuing, where that is interpreted so broadly and often without even consultation and explanation with the people, where essentially the default is to erase people as human beings when they're in prison, so that they can't have an opportunity to have their voice and name out there. If journalists contact them, the requests are often denied because of the fear of supposedly re-injuring victims. So I don't want to say that it's a fabricated fear, but it's just grossly exaggerated, and it's completely out of proportion. As a result, their First Amendment rights of incarcerated people have been just grossly abridged and continue to be. And I think that's very troubling.
Is there anyone fighting to change this?
No, not at this time that I know of.
The ACLU has been.
The ACLU has been filed some things.
Yeah, right. I don't imagine it's a popular cause for a politician to take.
No, it's not.
We have to protect the victims.
You agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, 100%. But then the flip side of it is, how do you balance it so that a person that's innocent, he cannot write a book or cannot write a newspaper article or do a TV interview to put forth his side of the, or her side of the story. And so how do you balance it out? Specifically in Maryland, they have the victim notification law, and I agree with it. I think that they should have a victim notification. If a victim,
Maryland is where you were in prison.
Yes. If victims sign a piece of paper that say, I want to be notified when this person goes for parole, when he's going to court, when they go to release, and now the media. And so they want to be informed of every, you know, all the movement. What I think that has done is that it has just, instead of notifying the victim and seeing if they have an issue with it, they just don't notify and just say automatically no. And I think...
Why is that?
Because I think it's perhaps too overwhelming.
Too much trouble.
Yeah, again, the facts have been, I've seen it over the years, where even for parole, open parole hearings where victims can come, that their address has changed and they didn't update it. And so therefore, so there's a, you know, a lot of complicated. And, you know, even if a prison were to call and say, hey, you know, leave a message, person probably doesn't want to listen to it anyway. And so if it's that painful, but there has to be a balance somewhere because a lot of rights are getting violated.
Sure. Mark, does this have an impact on sort of recidivism or how people feel coming out of prison?
The two main things that lower recidivism are contact with family and continuity and connections with the outside are one. And the second is education and programming, which has just a tremendously positive impact on people and prepares them for success when they get out. And Vince is actually a perfect example of that on both fronts, actually. But what this does is it deprives people of contact with the outside. What those who push these laws and policies are really doing is trying to wipe these people off the face of the earth. But the problem is 95% of people will be coming home.
It's well-intentioned, but in a fashion.
I think it's well-intentioned in the most abstract sense.
Right.
But the way it's applied is applied very maliciously. It's to simply completely erase people from the face of the earth while they're in prison. And that's just very damaging, even to ourselves as a society.
Of course.
And we tried to, in one prison that I was in, we tried to rebuild that because, you know, we were labeled inmates, prisoners, convicts. And we try to put that back in perspective and called ourselves incarcerated citizens because we don't lose all our rights. We are citizens of the United States, and we're going to be returning those that, you know, are citizens of our return to the community, 95% of them, as Mark said. And how do we want them coming out? Do we want them coming out always feeling they have a scarlet letter over their face, that they can't move forward, that they can't do anything, and then they get frustrated? And just the other day I heard of a person got out and couldn't handle the pressures and committed suicide because they're fearful of going back to such an environment that in the milieu of it all, it just loses its whole humanity. And then if people are just being overall treated on a lower level of humanity, but then you expect them to come out and be on a higher level of humanity, doesn't make sense to me.
What is the prospect for changing this? What is the hope for changing it? Do you feel like a voice in the wilderness?
A little bit. I mean, there is a constitutional right that prisoners have.
Which has been affirmed by the Supreme Court?
It's been affirmed by the Supreme Court, but not really very clearly defined. And so it's left a tremendous amount of leeway and interpretation to prison officials to decide whether there's sort of a security reason for a restrictive policy and infringement on people's First Amendment and other rights. I think there could potentially be challenges to that, and there have been some, and I think the ACLU has been active on this in terms of banning of certain books and the rights of people who are authors who are writing about fiction, let's say, have nothing to do with their own crime. I think we can all agree that somebody writing a book that is about their crime and tries to profit from it is something that shouldn't be allowed. But what if somebody's a good writer or a good artist or you know, has talent in other areas? They're still a human being, and if that talent is recognized and rewarded, shouldn't they be able to receive something from that, their families? There's an author in the state of Michigan who is very successful, it turns out now, and who has a wife and two children, and the state is trying to take over 90% of the royalties and of the income and then charging it back as sort of rent for a room and board for being incarcerated. That to me is a complete infringement of that person's rights. But it's all done in the name of service to victims, which again is something I take very seriously, and I know Vince does too and has for a long time. But it's something that has just gone too far. We're out of whack here. I think there are strong First Amendment challenges that could be made legally. There's not much movement on that front. It's, as you said, it's not a big political issue. There has been a lot of movement on overall criminal justice reform. I think there's been tremendous progress on humanizing people who've made mistakes in the past and helping support them for reentry. I think it's something we're seeing across the political spectrum. It's not a partisan issue. I'd like to see this First Amendment free speech issue become a part of that movement as well. It's not quite there, but I think it could be.
Is this an issue in federal prisons, by the way?
It's an issue in all prisons, federal and state.
Is it any better in federal prisons? Is there more hope for improvement of these restrictions and on the federal level?
I can't say for sure.
I can tell you in Maryland, because of security concerns, they attempted to limit only postcards coming into the prison. They limited Christmas cards and birthday cards from coming into the prison. So yes, that's a way that some contraband was introduced into the prison.
In birthday cards?
Yeah.
Christmas cards?
Some drugs that could be smuggled in that way.
That's why you have security in your mailroom, and that's why you open up the cards to find this contraband, or use drug sniffing dogs, or you come up with another form of how to deal with it, and saying that they're putting pressure on Maryland prisoners' families that you can only hug at the end of a visit. But how do you tell a six-year-old kid, no, you can't touch them, you can't touch them? They really have focused hard on the security aspect without looking again at the humanity of everybody, from the family of the prisoner to the victim and to the prisoner.
On this thing about books, I understand that in Texas, for example, it's okay to read Hitler's Mein Kampf, but not okay to read certain more progressive, more admirable American. What sort of things are banned in Texas as far as?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of books that deal with racial politics.
I see.
That
right.
deal with black power, that are very political, that are revolutionary, you might say. For whatever reason, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, for many people, falls into that category, even though that's really a...
She's just documenting the...
The rise in mass incarceration, and explaining it. In doing so, that's viewed as perhaps revolutionary, because it's actually opening people's eyes to the reality that has engulfed them.
One last issue I wanted to raise, which is how are prison education programs doing? I have had some involvement with this myself in the past as a president of a small college.
Yes.
And is the prison education movement growing? Is that
It is growing.
And is that something that victims are opposed to?
No, as far as I know, and I hope they don't become so. Prison education is the no-brainer issue involving criminal justice reform, because it's been proven. The RAND Corporation did a major meta study that shows that it reduces recidivism by 43%, has incredibly positive impact. Vince has been a part of this through the changes that he was able to make in prison through education, and I've seen it happen in countless people. And that's when we first met, actually, was when he was still incarcerated and I was teaching in a prison. It's an incredibly powerful and empowering experience to give people the tools to learn and grow and prepare them to succeed for when they're released. What the RAND Corporation found is every dollar spent on prison education has a $4 to $5 return in terms of reducing future incarceration costs by lowering recidivism. I mean, it's an absolute no-brainer. There has been a lot of progress. More and more programs are coming about, and Georgetown has been very involved, I'm glad to say, and it's one of my initiatives is to create a Georgetown prison education program, and there are a number of other universities. Goucher College was one of the early ones, and I think it's done a phenomenal job.
Personally, I went in with eighth grade education, attained a bachelor degree from Coppin State College, and then got my graduate degree. I found that it was so freeing, that this was freed me and was able to take blinders off of my eyes and be able to really deal with the good, the bad, and the ugly of why I was inside. I just thought it was so powerful that's why I stayed at in education, and I tutored in the daytime and ran the
in prison
and did college at nighttime. Education is so important, and as Mark pointed out, we are talking about the reduction of victimization of innocent people. When you have 95% success rate, who in their right mind, and the cost saving, how much money can you put on another crime and another victim? Let's not even talk about money when you talk about victimization.
Sure. So perhaps there's some grounds for optimism that the growth of prison education programs might lead gradually to restoration of free speech rights.
Absolutely. But there is an irony, which is that many of the students who are in those programs still do not have their free speech rights. In other words, if a newspaper or radio or other media broadcast wants to come into a prison and interview people, many of the people who are students in those programs who are doing really well, who might have a 3.9 GPA and be excelling in every respect, they still can't have their picture shown or their name used. And I think there's just something wrong with that.
Mark Howard is a professor at Georgetown University and the director of the Prisons and Justice Initiative. Vince Greco is a prisoners' rights advocate who spent more than 30 years in a Maryland prison. For an extended version of our conversation, you can visit the Speaking Freely section of our website, freespeechproject.georgetown.edu. Our project is funded by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. I'm Sanford Unger. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Speaking Freely.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.